Can start. First, welcome all of you to join this session in computer vision. It is my great pleasure to see so many friends from the computer vision community coming here. I know that we are going to meet with each other also soon in Hawaii, in CVPR. So today it's my great honor to have three prominent professors, former professors, to join this session, like to talk about different research. The first speaker is going to be Professor Rama Chilapa from University of Maryland. In the past several years, he has been working on IARPA Genesis program. Today, he's going to talk a little bit about his research on deep understanding of faces. So, Rama, the floor is
Thank
yours.
Thank you, gang, for inviting me. Good afternoon. So this talk is basically about the ongoing effort at University of Maryland with the six university partners. My colleague and friend, Larry Davis, is a co-PI on this effort. This is the IARPA Janus program. And Larry has been doing computer vision since 1976. I've been doing it since 1981. And this is probably the most difficult problem that we had to do. Although face recognition is generally seen as a solved problem, the kind of unconstrained face verification and recognition problem that we were asked to solve as part of the Janus program is pretty challenging. When I show you the kinds of numbers that they're expecting in terms of true acceptance rate at various false acceptance rates and so on, you'll see that. So we finished 3 years. We started in August 2014, and we have one more year to go. Before I get to the work we are doing in Janus, I'm 64 years old. If you have been a professor that long, you might have seen the same thing again at least twice or three times. So I still remember the 1987 neural network meeting in San Diego. They expected 500 people, 3,000 folks showed up, right? So neural networks is like a cat. A cat has 9 lives. I think we are in the 3rd life or something like this. We think after a while it'll go away. It goes away, it comes back again, bigger and so on, right? There are so many deep learning talks we heard today in the morning. So artificial neural networks came again in the mid-80s, and there were some early attempts at using deep networks. For example, Jan LeCun's work is very well known. And of course, in those days, we didn't have GPUs and we didn't have a lot of data, right? In the 70s, the Image Processing Institute, Brodat's texture album and so on was considered the standard data. So we didn't have a lot of data. And for my PhD, I worked with the PDP 1145 and shared it with 30 other PhD students. So you can imagine how much computing power I had. Okay, so since then, we have all this nice annotated data. Well, not perfect data, but a lot of data and GPUs, and there is some understanding about nonlinearities between the images and the labels and so forth. So it's applications pooling theory. In computer vision, we were very good in the 80s and 90s, a lot of theory, right? Regularization, manifold, this and that, and then applications were somewhat lacking. Now, suddenly, we find a lot of applications, and it kind of looks like it's working. At least the numbers are good, but we don't know a lot about why it's working, and that's where much work needs to be done. So this is basically what we were doing in those days. We had some neural networks for stereo, for optical flow, and we talked about MRFs and ANNs, Boltzmann machines, and so on. And I actually have a CVPR 1992 paper with Christoph van der Malsberg using dynamic link architecture, which is a generalization of neocognitron for face verification. We had about 350 subjects and so forth. And, of course, this is the one that's now creating a lot of excitement, right? The convolutional neural networks and so on. And at that time, I like to say this because, there was the DARPA image understanding program. And, a neural network was kind of seen as somewhat a threat because it looked like a pattern recognition, and it is a pattern recognition machine. And there is this constant stress, between pure computer vision and pure PR. But if you now go to CVPR, there is a lot of PR and very little CV, looks like, right? So we should call it PR or something like that. Anyway, so, which is good, but my feeling is that it's true. It looks like a black box, but the numbers are good. I'm going to show you. And so let's accept that, and then let's try to figure out why it's working well and what more things we can do. And it's not the fault of CNN, it's a black box. It's our fault if we are not able to analyze it. That's how I see it. So It's a very hierarchical nonlinear regression machine. Now, if we think the computer vision problems, the space of problems that we can solve can be solved by a hierarchical nonlinear regression machine, then we have found the perfect machine. But that's not so, because geometry is still missing. And that's a big deal for us in the 80s and 90s, so we need to come back to that. So I'll discuss all of this later. So the Janus program is it's really a very tough program. And we have to do a lot of things. Verification, given two faces, are they from the same person? We have to search. And we have to do subject-specific clustering. And it has to be end-to-end. It has to be automatic. And at 10 power minus 4 false acceptance rate, we have at least 85% true acceptance rate. Okay? And they give you images right off the internet. It's not like a driver's license or a passport picture. So, all right? So it's an all-university team. Maryland is the lead. And we have Deva Ramanan from CMU, Shifu Chang from Columbia, and Vishal Patel from Rutgers, Venu Govindaraju from Buffalo, Terry Bowl from UC Colorado Spring, and Alice Watul from University of Texas, Dallas. Okay? So when we started, you know, we were thinking of some hierarchical structures that we will need, but we were really not thinking in terms of CNN. But within 6 months, it was clear, unless we did CNNs, we are not going to meet the metrics. So that's what it is. So if there are three or four teams, and if one of them uses CNN and you don't, you lose, period. Right? That's really what happened here. So everybody is doing CNN in Janus, okay, various kinds. So here we have to do end-to-end. It's automated, so we do face detection. And then we designed a face detector, not just this face detection. It's called UltraFace. It does a lot of other things, fiducials. It does pose. It does gender. It does age and so on, because we want to bring in all this information. And then we have, you know, three different kinds of networks. What we found was different networks behave differently at low far and high far, okay? So we have to bring in multiple networks and then fuse the representations and so forth. So the details of our phase one Janus work are in an IJCV paper. It's probably in archives somewhere. We wrote it up in full detail, how to go about end-to-end automated unconstrained phase verification problem. Phase one. The difference between phase one system and phase two system is more things that we have added. Okay, so, and also as a professor, you know, we really don't build systems, right? We write a lot of papers and so on. So this is a bit of a departure for me and Larry and all the team members. Here we said we are going to build a system that exceeds the expectations of phase two from IARPA. So we sat down to build this as a system, right? So that's what we did. So these are all the various tasks. The other idea here is Janus, it's not a single image. It could be a single image. It could be multiple stills. It could be video. So it could be any one of those things, because that's how image analysts get their data. They're not always getting a single image. So when you have a representation, if you have multiple images, you need to come out with what is known as flattening of the feature, because you're going to have feature sets for each image. How do you come up with one feature that characterizes the image set? Or if it is a video, how are you going to do the flattening? So that's called a template. So this is not just a still or just a video. It's a template-based thing. So that's something new, because that's the operational scenario. And then covariates is what happens to the performance when you have illumination, pose, age, and all of that. And then search. Search is, you know, ranking them. And they said, we are not going to give you any phases, so you have to detect them yourself. And the scale varies quite a bit, you know, phase, right? They just pick it up from the internet. And then, you know, these are all the various tasks. Okay, so the data sets, IJBA is available now. We had three data sets, CS0, CS1, CS2, CS3. Now we are working with CS4, and the increasing complexity is if you want to get the data set, you just can go now and get IJBA. I know Gang has worked with it. Now IJBB is available, which is CS3. You don't have the videos. You just have the stills. So you will have an idea of how complex this is. So the most recent data set is CS4, which has 3,500 subjects and 21 still images and video frames sampled from 1179 videos and so on. Right? So, and the IARPA also wanted us to know how we will figure with the million distractors. As you know, Megaface has this million distractors. So how would your performance stand? So our unique features are that we started doing some multitask learning in the first stage itself. basically, if you look at deep layers, you know, multiple layers behave differently. So the bottom several layers, you can actually use the features for doing many related things, right? Detection, pose, and all of that. So that's what we do. You just have to define different loss functions. Gender is a two-class problem. Detection is a two-class problem. So you can have cross-entropy loss and so on. Fiducials and pose is a regression problem. So you can have the appropriate cost functions. And then you can train them very well. And this is somewhat like group study. You know, when you're in college, before the finals, a bunch of us sit together with the Starbucks and then try to help each other out. The idea is everybody gets an A, and that's something that we see is happening here. Because for the different tasks, the amount of training data that's available is different. For age estimation, there's not as much data. For face detection, there's a lot more data. So you can actually train for face detection and use some of those features for the age estimation. So you can do this multitask learning. And then we also started thinking of using 3D models, but it didn't really, we didn't really need that. Other teams are doing it. We thought we'll just design different networks. So I like to call it, you know, the team of rivals. So you can tailor make them so that one of them will do very well at low FARS, other one will do at high FARS, and so on. And then you can bootstrap from there to get a flat response. And our idea is to have relatively small data training sets. We don't have millions of faces. We have just used 3.5 million. And then we need to do hashing because, you know, search over million and so forth. Okay, so Shifu is helping that. The other thing was full video-based recognition. Okay, so there are not that many papers on video-based face verification, so that is something we had to do. And of course, as professors, we publish a lot. So this is the idea of UltraFace. When we are able to do detection, pose, the pitch, yaw, and roll, age, in FGNet, we are about within 2 years of accuracy, and smile, no smile, and so on. And this is the kind of structure that we built. And this is available in archives, so I won't belabor much on that. There are two kinds of tasks you can do, subject-independent tasks, right? Detection, fiducial, and so on. And then subject-specific features. So we deal with them differently in terms of getting them to converge. And these are the various training data set. As I said before, for some tasks, you have a lot more than others. So if for age, gender and age, you have 55,000, 19,000, and so on, that's really not enough to train a network by itself. You know, one needs a lot more than that. But if you have some other data sets and they are related, you can kind of leverage out of that. And that's one thing that we found. So Euclidean loss is useful for pose and regression, fiducials and so on. Okay, so this is typical. Any arbitrary image, this is from the Janus database, any arbitrary face comes, we can detect it and tell you what the age is, gender, smile, and pose, and so on. And this is useful for aligning before you extract your features and so on. Okay, and of course, we have to, when you want to publish these things, you also have to do on classical data sets because not everybody has access to CS3 and CS4. So whenever we submit to conferences, they say, well, we don't know about this data set. So we have to go and try it on the standard, FDDB, AFW, and all that stuff. Okay, so that's what you have to do. Now, in the early stages, the idea was that since there's not enough training data set, maybe we should build 3D models and synthesize lots of training data, right? That's the approach taken by our other two teams that are in Janus. We kind of tried that for a while. Then we said, let's just go and build different networks. So we have a small network that is, I named the networks after my students, which is a very psychological experiment you can do. Because if it doesn't work at some point, you can say, Ankan, your network is not working, and it gets very personal, works very hard, and make it better. So if you have networks, just name them after your students. They like it. Because we put their name and we say, Ankan is not working here, but JC is better, and so on. So it's a kind of a nice psychological experiment you can do. So we use AlexNet, ResNet, InceptionNet, and so on. And then there is this triplet probabilistic embedding, something that we developed at Maryland. So we have these three features. There are a couple of things you can do. You can do feature fusion using another CNN. Or you can do score level fusion and all of that. Okay, so training, we are really very poor when it comes to training data set. The MSN worm, I think it has 10 million, but we really had to curate it to remove the noise and so on and brought it down to 3.5 million. Still, there is noise. Of course, there is a general belief in the neural network side, if you train using noisy data, it will generalize well. I mean, that's kind of like a folklore. You know, my analogy is, if your soup doesn't have salt, yeah, you can add a little bit of salt to make it tasty, but you cannot continue to add salt, right? That's going to screw it up. So we don't know really how much noise should be there or not. And training hours, well, thank God for GPUs. Otherwise, we would not have been able to achieve any of these. And then we do metric learning and so on. So, you know, there's not, later on I will talk about some other things we do. Anyway, so Fusion CNN is basically we have three networks. We take those features and we fuse them and get one vector, and then we do the triplet probabilistic embedding. Right now, it's like, I think, you know, very, very small amount of representation. I don't know if I have the number here. I think after hashing, it's about 3,072 bits or something like that for a face. It's really, really very small amount of information that we are using. And then we realized that for us to work well, we have to have larger data sets. So we went and collected lots of still as well as videos, okay? Because, you know, we wanted to train using videos themselves. So this is UMD Faces data set. It's available. You can download and play with it. And we tried to build this data set so that it kind of approximates the distribution of CS4 Janus data sets. Okay, so, this is, you love it, you hate it, but numbers are good. And I can tell you, without deep learning, I won't have these numbers. I know that. I've been doing face recognition since 1992. We have tried lots of different things. Okay, so what do you do? Right? 10 power minus 4. IARPA wanted us to do 85%. We are at 91.2. 10 power minus 3, you know, false alarm rate is 95, we are 95.3. And phase 3 metric will be at e power minus, 10 power minus 5, probably 85. IARPA worries about 10 power minus 5, 10 power minus 6 operations. You know, you are able to allow to make 1 in 10 power 6 mistakes, but you have to be accurate 85%, 95%. These are tough numbers. I can tell you that, very tough numbers. And so we are in a situation where there is something that looks like it's working. It doesn't have any post-invariance, it doesn't have any elimination invariance. Any invariance you are doing it is by giving it a lot of diverse training data set, hopefully it learns, right? That's the hope. So we are not sure exactly how this is going, but everybody is on to this one. And you can see for the covariates, 65% at e power minus 4. So these are very, very good numbers, and we are able to do more. And this is kind of illustrates what happens with different networks. The purple one, as you can see, does very well at 10 power minus 2, 10 power minus 3, but falls off very rapidly when you go to low false alarm. On the other hand, if you look at the green one, it is a little bit more flatter, right, relatively speaking. So if you fuse them, you get this guy. And this is where 10 power minus 5, we are around there, okay? 10 power minus 4, we are around there, okay? So this is an encouraging sign. Because I sometimes like to joke with my students, we are not used to having computer vision systems work as expected and so on. So here is one example. And you have to do a search, again, 97, rank 1 is 95. In rank 10 and so on, right? And they have a metric for face detection, fiducials, how many you get, and so forth. So the numbers are very encouraging. Then the question is, what happens if you have distractors? Okay, this is the megaphase thing. So we actually use the 1 million distractors from megaphase. So if you have no distractors, then you have the one on the top, and the bottommost one with this color is a million distractors. If you look at the rank 1, it is about 83%. Whereas if you look at without any distractors, it is about 95%. Okay? And then, it kind of doesn't fall apart completely, right? So this is one more test. Because, it's quite likely that the gallery will not be all just the persons you are looking for. There will be everybody else. So other thing that we have to worry about is sublinear search. One of the things that IARPA is interested in when you go over large data sets is sublinear. And so we use hashing methods from Columbia. Shifu is one of the best persons doing hashing. And as you can see in the top curve, this and the green, with no distractors and with hashing, you're losing a little bit. And then 10,000, million without hashing and with hashing, you have the bottom two curves. So we are not losing much in terms of performance, and it is a sublinear logarithmic search. So this is one thing that we have been asked to do, right? So we are also asked to do clustering. Just given a lot of images, okay, how do you put them in different baskets using features? So this is an example of the same guy, and the green is when, by our curating procedure, it didn't put him in the right basket. We do the deep features and cluster it and put him in the right basket. Red really corresponds to the wrong person. So this is one of the criterion in the task, that subject-specific clustering, okay? Now, full motion, complete video, not a still, not as a frame, and we are able to get 79% using a combination of dictionary-based methods and CNN. So, of course, you can view this as a black box and you can play with it. The way I see it is it's like Model T car, Buggy headlights, long stick in the steering wheel, park benches as the seats. This was how the car was first. So CNN is somewhat like that. But there is enough potential for everybody to play with it and learn from it, right? So we talked about performance bounds. When the distribution or the training and the testing data are same, if you know how much error you are making in the training data, how can you bound the testing? We have done that. And we also did smart sampling of training data. Once we build a CNN with certain performance, if you have a lot more training data, you can take a batch of 1,000 and choose from the 1,000 how many you want to use for improving the performance. So these are some of the things we can do, and expression recognition and so on. And of course, there is a lot of interest in the NIPS community about adversarial networks. So we combine adversarial networks and domain adaptation, which basically tackles the data bias between training and distribution and so on. So all of these papers are on archive. So I think deep networks are here to stay for a while, okay? Let's accept that. It's accessible to high school students. I get high school interns, and one of them says, I got 5 in AP statistics, I want to work on a regression problem. I said, okay, use deep networks and find the age of a person. In 3 months, download CAFE, get the data, run, and they get some plots, and they have a workshop paper and some computer vision thing. They are excited. So when did computer vision become accessible to high school students? So what's wrong in that, right? So then I have another kid who took pictures of various foods and figured out what the glycemic index is, what the calorie is, by using fast RCNN and so on. And easily portable software. In the good old days when we developed a vision system, we want to give it to somebody else. It was very challenging. Now, once you tell people CAFE, this, that's it, they understand immediately. And the system that we build, it gets evaluated at various places, NIST, at Noblis, and it runs. In universities, we think we have achieved technology transition if the code runs in the other floor, right? That's how, But now this thing runs at somebody else's organization, and that's very important because this has always been a challenge, being in the university and developing something that can be ported. And they allow end-to-end solutions, and there's still a lot of challenges. All the traditional vision issues are still there. We have not, really changed much of that. Anything we did in the 80s and 90s with invariances and this and that, everything is still there, okay? So, but we do have a little toy to play with. If you want to give another analogy, it's something like accelerator that particle physicists, they build it and they do experiments with it and so on. So we do now have a machine that we can build and see what it does and what it cannot do. And I think we should enjoy this. I know it's difficult for vision people to kind of accept that what we do has some interesting performance, but that's reality. Let's enjoy it. I don't know how long this will continue, maybe for a few years. I'm sure we will do something else after that, but there's enough scope for theory. Statistics is very hard when you have 101 layers, nonlinearities, nested structure, and so on. We don't know what that regression machine does. That's true. Statistics does simple, nice, linear, Gaussian. Nonlinear, it does a little bit. and so on. So we can still analyze it from information theory, the capacity of the networks, generalizability, and so on. So there is immense scope for theoretical work. Okay, but it's also a nice toy to play with. So let's enjoy it as long as the ride continues. Thank you very much for your time.
Is there any questions? I think we can take perhaps two questions because of timing.
Yeah. Any at this moment any computer vision problem that cannot be solved by deep learning?
Well, I told you, right? A deep learning is nothing but a hierarchical nonlinear regressor, right?
Yes.
So there are space of solutions that particular machine can solve, and I don't think all computer vision problems can be posed as a nonlinear regression problem. So we have to find that space. It's not spanned as a regression problem, nonlinear regression. Because the whole idea of neural network is functional approximation, right? You know, a classifier is a mapper from input to labels, and to the extent then you can approximate that, then you are good to go. But vision is more about that. Vision is more about all the other issues, you know, occlusion, pose, illumination, and all of that. So there are problems that are sitting in the space, not spanned by a nonlinear regressor. So that's what I think we need to find out. Yeah. Yes, sir.
So you said there's a lot of work left to do in incorporating invariants in deep networks.
Yeah.
What particular problems are you thinking of, and more so, what solutions?
Transfer learning is something that people talk about. We do a lot of work on domain adaptation, when the distribution of the data bias is there. So we understand how to do it on the manifolds using dictionaries and so on. Now I think we can, the way I saw, I think I was thinking of it, it's like a tree, you know, with multiple, you know, branches with multiple fruits and so on, right? So whichever you want, you know, you can climb on that and things like that. So the idea here is how do you take, for example, when we did the expression recognition, right? We took the network that we trained for face verification, and when we tried for expression recognition, and then you do fine-tuning, and you look at the visual thing, it still behaves like a face identifier, verifier. It does not know how to unlearn what it has been trained on so that it can now do well on the expression task. Right? So when you want to change to different tasks, fine-tuning is not just doing it. So we need to understand which layers are amenable for you know, training so that it will work on the other problem, right? So I think generalizability is still an issue, okay? And again, the only hope I have here is because it's a challenging data set. If this were pi constrained data set, you know, we cannot be so optimistic that it's doing something. But this is a very, you know, you can go and take a look at the data set. It's a very challenging, you know, data set, and the performance is, none of us thought it will work this well when we started, okay? And in fact, so much so, IARPA increased the challenge. They wanted first 85% at 10 power minus 3. They made it 95% at 10 power minus 3 and 85% for phase 2 in the middle of the program. Because when they did the BAA, CNN was not there at that time in a big way. They said, wait a minute, CNN is doing all this well. You can do better. So, you know, so that's what, so which is good, I think, right? It's a very defined problem. Phase verification identification is a very well-defined problem. Maybe that's why this is useful, because there are lots of other vision problems are not so well-defined, right? So then maybe it's not going to be effective. Yeah, that's what I think.
Let's take the last question. I just want to ask a comment, probably. You said a neural network is a great equalizer. That's great. You know, have a lot of fun. But now I'm worried that, you know, if you high school students and then master students, PhD students, they're all equalized. Why they want to go to PhD?
No, they don't have to. In fact, you know, not many are going, right? Listen, if there is a company that says, all we want you to know is to how to run a CNN for this problem, I think they can hire a high school student. There's nothing wrong in it. But that won't work for all problems, right? So now actually it's going to, it is very interesting. You know, I gave a senior level course on machine learning. Right, And fourth class, everybody wants to learn deep learning. I said, wait, before we go to deep, let's learn some shallow learning. And then we will do the deep. So kids are excited. I think it's good that our field is in a situation where people are giving so much attention. And I think it's good. We should not be so pessimistic, and we should grab it. But as I said, there is enough theory to be done from a statistics point of view, from model fitting point of view, from everything. So there is enough. Somebody wants to really figure out what's going on with this, I think there is plenty of thing to do. And it is. I don't consider it a negative thing that high school students can download, because when it comes to PhD, you're not going to give PhD somebody for downloading cafe and running some experiments. You're going to expect more. So there is that thing that we do. But it is good that, for example, one of the high school kids, I said he went to IHOP, and then he took pictures of various things. He went to Lebanese Tavern pictures, and then he was comparing his fast CNN, segmenting them, and coming up with approximate calories, and he's building an app on his Android. Yeah, why not? Let them have fun. Vision is accessible now. That's good, right? So we should not be concerned about that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Let's thank Professor Rama Chalapa again for the great talk. Yeah. So the second speaker is Dr. Katsu Ikevichi. He's currently a researcher with Microsoft Research Asia, but he's physically located in Redmond. He used to be a professor at the University of Tokyo, and he likes Microsoft so much, so after retirement, he joined Microsoft. Today, he's going to talk about the robotics and the AI. And hopefully, you are going to add some computer vision components into it.
Oh, yeah,
right? Sure. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So today's talk is robotics and AI, and a little bit of history, actually. And beginning of AI, basically, people think AI began around Dartmouth Conference in 1956. And these guys are main player at that time. And at that time, robotics, computer vision, and AI are synonyms around that time. And in fact, the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, one of the few AI centers at that time, conducted the following robotics research as AI research. And one of them is called the copy demo after 15 years at Dartmouth, basically to use this kind of image dissectors. And then, to understand the structure of the block, and then manipulate this one and then make a copy of this world. And this work was done by Tom Binford, Pat Winston, and BKP Horn, and of course, Marvin Minsky is the guy. And then, after 25 years, around that time, I'm working over there, and so-called beam picking problem. And observe this kind of scene by using a photometric stereo system, and then obtain surface orientation. And to make from that surface orientation to generate so-called Gaussian, extended Gaussian image. And comparing extended Gaussian image and stored Gaussian image, we can determine object attitude. And once you know that one, then you can pick up. And since from which direction we pick up the object, so a robot can put this kind of stick, actually. Namely, the goal of the AI at that time is to create so-called artificial life form, which has three components, sensing, cognition, and actions. And the important point is autonomous, automatic. There is no human intervention at that time. And then, however, that three component has lots of challenges. So reductionism, important guy says, reductionism is important. And then around 1984, robotics people separate from Ichikai. And 1987, vision people separate from Ichikai and form ICCB and E-class. And that is around 30 years after the Dartmouth. Since then, people are talking separately and using different language. So these three communities cannot talk each other. That is a problem. And in fact, my history is also just reductionism. And from robotics, I also go to the computer vision and beam picking and robot motion from observation. And I borrow 5 minutes and overlook this robotics effort. And the problem of this bin picking system is, where is the intelligence? Well, of course, you know, this robot looks intelligent, but intelligent guy is myself. I think about all cases and think about all conditions and make a program. So robot is stupid. Just I'm a clever guy, actually. And this is a kind of a teleoperation through program. There is no intelligence. So I thought maybe it's a good idea to generate a robot which automatically generates a program. But from where? So I thought maybe it's a good idea if human robot observe human action and generate a program automatically, then that robot is intelligent. So I began to this business around 1986, actually. And the first system which combat, and then, however, theoretically, of course, computer vision is difficult. But theoretically, if you have all precise data, and then if computer knows all precise data, theoretically, robot can follow that action, theoretically. But in reality, of course, this kind of situation occurs. Why? Because, human balance and robot balance is different, and also, human height and robot height is different, and similar things are occurring between human teacher and human student, because human student and human teacher has a different height, different weight, different body structures. Roughly same structure, but precisely speaking, different structure. So we shouldn't be able to direct mimicking. Rather, important point is, from this action, we have to extract essence of action, and then based on that essence, we should map that one to robot actions. That is the idea of learning from observations. And in fact, following that idea, after the 30 years.
Today, humans have construct robots for kind of a variety of tasks and interactive techniques, such as teach pendant.
An important point is, this system observes human action soon.
However, in many applications, these techniques are found to be cumbersome and impractical. At the learning from observation lab,
observe like that action,
investigating new ways
and then understand structure and mimic the same actions.
We have developed a system.
Yeah, of course, system is only handle two blocks. But the important point is, this system has this kind of state transitions. A side B, A on top of B, B side A, B on top of A. And if we recognize previously we are here, and currently we are here, by extracting this kind of structure, we can estimate what kind of robot action we can generate this kind of state transition. And following that idea, we design various learning from observation system. And again, this important guy says divide and conquer. So, I divide the area for the two blocks world, machine part and human dancing too, actually. And quick tour, first, around 40 years after the dark mass, observing this kind of continuous motion to analyze face contact transition like that. Basically, arbitrary polyhedra can be classified one of these 10 states. And once you know this state, you can estimate what kind of robot action generates such kind of state action and can generate this kind of motion. Originally at CMU in 1994, and then later, 2002 in Tokyo, actually. And, daily life object. And, even human dancing. Observing human dancing, at that time, I only know how to describe lower body. So at that time, we use upper body, just joint angle, actually. And then, from this kind of observation, we can generate this kind of action. And now I have found that how to describe upper body. So by using that one, we again create this kind of observing that that dance, and then. Important point is, human gesture can be described by using this kind of symbolic representation called lava notations. So I really fascinated this lava notation. So next 5 minutes, detour from, based on this lava notation. And further detour from robotics. And by using this lava notation, we can do relatively good things. First of all, we can discriminate whether that is same dance or a different dance. Let's suppose, take a look at this video. Is it same dance or a different dance? In my opinion, different dance. Who disagree? Different dance, right? So, you know. Let's go to next movie. How about this one? Same, right? But precise motion is different, right? The key issue is why some of the human action is classified same dance set, some of them classified different dance. How to define this same dance set? In fact, by using this lava notation, we can classify same class of dance. Basically, what is lava notation? This lava notation is invented by Rudolf Laban, who around the mid-20s, actually. So basically, this body part is described in the column, and time flow from bottom to top, and each column representing particular directions. And how long does it take such motion is written like this structures. This is called lava notation. Why we care lava notation? Because when you observe dance describe lava notation, another dance describe lava notation, then if this lava notation is same, you can guarantee this two motion is classified same perceptual group. So this lava notation is kind of a music note. When you listen to music, you can write it down music note. Any musician write it down the same music note. From the same music note, any musician can play roughly same music, slightly different. But essence, you can listen to music, you can say, oh, this is the same music. The same way, if you see the same dance and you write it, end up the same lava notation, that is a guarantee that it is the same dance. So by using this lava notation, first of all, we can record Taiwanese dance. Why Taiwanese dance? Some theory says original Taiwan people is expanded into entire Southern Pacific. So if we analyze, we may be able to classify culture of these people, actually. That is the motivation why I'm interested in to classify this Taiwanese folk dance. And currently, by Taiwanese government, there is 14 tribes exist. So we collect various dance like that, and then write it down, lava notation. Like this. And of course, you know, lots of. Now, we created all lava notation of all 14 dances. Not of all 14, 14 tribes dances, 28 or something. And once you have the lava notation, of course, by using this lava notation, you can reconstruct this kind of dance. A little bit fake, though, due to the limitation of robot. But anyway, you can recreate the dance. So in that sense, we can preserve cultural heritage by using this lava notation. And let's see. Another interesting point is, by using this lava notation, we can investigate cultural difference between tribes, actually. And since we have the 14 tribes that dance, so by using this dance structure and lava notation, we can classify these 14 people like this dendrogram. Okay, at 10 minutes. And then, once you have this dendrogram, you're also interested in how this dendrogram is similar to other dendrogram coming from other sources. First of all, I check the dendrogram based on DNA. And this is a dendrogram of this people, similarity of this people based on DNA. Of course, totally different. You know, of course, you know, if you are born in US, come to Japan, you can dance Japanese dance, right? So DNA is totally independent of culture. Yeah, clear. Next thing I check is dialect. They use four different dialects: Eastern dialect, Southern dialect, Central dialect, Northern dialect. And again, similarity of the language, we can create this kind of a dendrogram of these peoples. And in fact, you know, roughly their structure is similar, but detail is slightly different. Another factor which I check is social structures, social institutions, how social position is inherited in this 14 people. Aristocratic people, leaders some become leader, nobility some become nobility. Such a social position is fixed. Non-aristocratic, anyone, strongest guy become a leader. So I found and majority is just non-aristocratic, so I need more details. So whether maternity, you know, whether, you know, how that, you know, property is inherited. Maternity society, mother's asset is inherited to the eldest daughters. Paternity society, man's father's asset is inherited to the eldest son. And again, this is a majority. So father we need. So how they behave in the group, actually. And then by using such a system, we can classify these 14 tribes like that. And in fact, this structure is quite similar to the dance structures. It means social institution and dance is quite similar, and folk dance and society structure closely related. And in fact, this is one of the examples CS technology can help preserve cultural heritage as well as help some other scientific discipline. In this case, I'm calling cyber humanities. Now back to business, 10 minutes actually. And now, after 60 years from the Dartmouth, some of the Cambrian explosion is occurring in robotics. So many robots. Papers, CVPR, huge number. You know, when I was a program chair at the CVPR 96, participants only 500 people. Now they are talking 4,000 people actually. So some of the explosion is occurring. I think it's time to think about paradigm shift. Too much reductionism makes a discipline so fragmental, and each person cannot talk each other. That is a problem. Rather, we should introduce holism to merge together under a clear goal. In fact, you know, there was a robotics area in the holism idea and the system architecture. In Rodney Brooks, think about this kind of closed loop, so-called subsumptions. Reflex group and cognition groups and recognition group. And this kind of loop structures. So I check, you know, how I am doing in this ideas. And in fact, in my robotics work, yes, reflex is existing, recognition is existing, but this cognition is missing. So I create a cognition loop. And fortunately, Microsoft is a good position. So, you know, we create this kind of hardware independent cognition loop. So, you know, from this human chatting to this robot to recognize such a face recognition, a speech, they all supplied by Microsoft, and then chatting robot, and then missing component is gestures. So translation from body language, translation from spoken language into body language is missing. So I created that routines. And how I did is I prepare concept and action pairs. Concept and action pair like that. The reason is, canned conversation, you can expect what kind of answer system generate. So we can assign appropriate robot action. But usual chatting bot, we cannot expect what kind of answer will be returned. So we need a system to translate spoken language into body language. So we create this system, and we prepare this gesture library, which is pair of the concept and gesture. And gesture is written by using Lava notations. We create this 40 concept pairs first, and then once chatting engine generates some of the expression by using Microsoft program again to analyze how that sentence is similar to one of the 14 concepts. And if we choose, oh, that sentence seems to me agree concept group, then we extract this gesture corresponding to this agree group and generate. And in fact, a few minutes ago, our engineer generated this kind of demonstration system. Now, 2 minutes actually. Further, this important guy says, or current, maybe he's not said, but in my mind, he said, oh, current chatting robot is just a composition component. There is no idea the robot system is optimized for the environment. So we have to define environment. So what is the environment? In fact, the environment is a kind of application areas. Industrial robot, field robot, and a service robot like that. And we analyze what kind of capability is necessary in this particular environment. And it turned out all the environment, basically they are talking about automatic system. But new environment, dynamic environment, close to contact, and augmentation is important rather than automations. So basically human environment goals, elderly cares, and requirement, face recognition, of course, conversation tuned to the users. The point is tuned to the users. Situation engine tuned to the users. And knowledge tuned to the users. Like that, a component is necessary. And one final question is, however, does current AI system want to learn? AlphaGo want to learn to Go? I don't think so. None of the system want to learn for themselves. Simply, human programmer prepare data set and give it to the system. Then system learn. There is no intention. Does any system have self-consciousness? I don't think so. Important guy say, life form exists for soul. The other important guy say, I think, therefore I am. So maybe if the goal of AI system is to create an artificial form, we should design artificial soul. But is it a good idea to design artificial soul? Of course, as a elderly care system, I think some kind of fuzzy artificial soul is important. Now, when you are thinking about the soul, there are two types of soul. One is Terminator type, enemy, kill human, that dangerous actually. And this is complete autonomous system. So we shouldn't aim artificial intelligence for robot. Rather, AI means Doraemon type, human friendly, help human, augment human, and to cooperate and augment human physical and intellectual ability. This is called augmented reality, augmented intelligence. Basically, robot soul for human friendly robot. Robot should be a friend of human. Human is a master, creator. And the robot and human should cooperate each other. And the robot is embodiment AI. But AI not mean artificial intelligence. that AI means augmented intelligence. And actually, this augmented intelligence is coming from large ready, actually. So summary, new application area, such as a service robot and partially field robot, require dense contact between human and robot. So in that particular area, robot is not necessarily a complete autonomous system. Rather, if there is an exception, system can ask human and help human, actually, and also robot and human cooperate each other, augmented intelligence. Today, I talk about the reductionism and holism, but I'm from Eastern culture, meaning from Japan, and in Japanese sense, we should combine. Of course, we have to reductionism, and we are talking about holism, but that is first stage. And second stage of reductionism occurs, and then second level of the holism occurs, and 30,000 reductionism occurs, then we can become a Buddha, actually. Why 30,000? According to Buddhist theory, there is 3,000 world in the world, and we are living this 3,000 world, actually. And probably, maybe it takes 100 years, but soon, maybe 1 minute, I don't know. Thank you very much.
So, any questions here? Katsu, let me pose one first question here. So, if we think about like a 3,000 world here, like which stage we are in? Like you are talking about 3,000 years.
We are still, here, you know, so. Maybe this stage, though, unfortunately.
Sure.
Okay. Hi, Katsu. That was a great talk. Really wonderful. I have two questions, actually, yes. If I could. So the Lab Nation, is there some website or set of papers that would describe that in more detail so that, you know, people could find out more about that?
Oh, no, not yet, actually.
Okay. And the other question is, have you looked at cognitive architectures? It's a kind of software system where they try to model big chunks of mind.
Right.
Skill learning, and they do integrated versions, some on physical robots, some as softbots. Do any of those strike you as particularly interesting or useful from the standpoint of where you're trying to go?
Yeah, actually, in that sense, you know, chunk is corresponding concept group, actually. And, you know, so in that sense, I'm using such chunk idea in the learning from observation paradigm. But still, you know, I only analyze and create each chunk at each domain. And the next level is probably to how to merge two chunks into the meta chunk, actually. And still, I haven't have that theory yet.
Okay, because of timing, let's thank the speaker again. Thank you. So.